thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Bukhari Sellers Podcast. Today, we'll be interviewing one of my Morehouse brothers and psychiatrist, Dr. Thomas Oden. I mean, one of the things that you realize is that on this show, we do place a huge emphasis on mental health. And this episode is focused on that. But before we get to Dr. Oden, I have to talk about what happened last Friday. And the House vote passing the president's $1.2 trillion physical infrastructure package and putting it on the president's desk, and the procedural rule to move forward with the $1.75 trillion human infrastructure package known as the Build Back Better Act. The physical infrastructure package is a big fucking deal. I mean, it's a BFD. There's no doubt about it. This is the most money we've ever spent as a country in the basics like bridges, roads, broadband, and clean water. But something that got a lot of attention on the internet, at least, were the six Democratic no votes for the infrastructure package. Representatives Bush, Bowman, Omar, Presley, Tlaib, and Ocasio-Cortez, a.k.a. the Squad. As much as the votes to pass the legislation were critical, I think those six votes said something, too, that many people have lost in translation and may have been lost in the discussion, particularly when we consider that the broader spending package is still very much in the balance. What those six votes were about was a lack of trust in moderate Democrats, both in the House and in the Senate, like West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin, who took a $6 trillion package to a $3.5 trillion package to now a $1.75 trillion package. They were also about a group of moderates who insisted that money for healthcare and housing and childcare be completely paid for, and it is, while also insisting that the infrastructure package be passed, knowing full well that it would be deficit financed to the tune of almost $260 billion. And it's worth noting that they only voted no after it was clear that some Republicans would support the bill. So it's not like they don't support infrastructure. They took issue with moderates going back on the deal that both bills would be voted out together. And while we were close, we only passed the procedural rule for the $1.75 trillion package, not the actual bill, which progressives' position was all along. So the president and leadership in the House and Senate have to bridge this trust gap and get this done, because there's still a lot of mistrust that has to be addressed between moderates and progressives on this. And the progressives aren't necessarily wrong, at least on principle. Moderates have been the holdouts this entire time, often for pretty disingenuous reasons or no clear reasons at all. And we need them to join the team and play ball and pass this damn bill so we can get this over with. And that's that on that. Now on to our interview with Dr. Thomas Oden. Welcome to another episode of the Bukhari Sellers Podcast. Today is another dope episode. I get to interview one of my homeboys from back in the day. We have none other than Dr. Thomas Oden. How you feeling today, man?
Pretty good. How you doing?
Man, long time no see. We got to do a better job of keeping up with each other. And I know COVID has made it tough, but I hope you and yours are well, my brother.
Jaded, likewise.
For sure. We start each one of our episodes by having our guest walk us through the arc of their career. So talk to us about each of your career stops since Morehouse and Boston University to now having your own psychiatric practice. And why did you choose psychiatry as your specialty?
Sure. I think the really getting into psychiatry started from kind of somewhat of an early age. I mean, I grew up in New Orleans, a very vibrant Black city full of a lot of culture. But in the South, it's a small city, so you know people going through different stuff. You see the highs and lows, right? You can't escape that. So I knew growing up, I was attuned to people's emotions. I really felt that like skill set personally. Mm-hmm. Grew up playing jazz. Also, that was a lot of social connections that way. But knew early on I wanted to become a doctor, had medical knowledge. Then at Morehouse, I realized psychology was the right path. I really wanted to understand human behavior. How does someone get to that point? You know, like everyone has these goals and dreams, but how does someone end up homeless? What happened, you know, and how does our interactions with others affect us long term? And so I felt like Morehouse, majoring in psychology, that was one big point. I knew I wanted to go into psychiatry. I wanted to interface between medical knowledge as well as having the foundation of psychology and human behavior, neurology, physiology, all that connected. And so after Morehouse, I worked at a child psych hospital as a behavioral tech, had a chance to really work with kids very intensely in that capacity. Also did some research in genome research at Columbia, then did autism research at UC Davis, and then went to med school at Boston University School of Medicine. going in there, that was obviously a big transition between New Orleans to Atlanta to Boston, you know, and did the best I could with that. And by the time that was over, though, I definitely wanted to go back home. So I did my psychiatry training at Tulane in New Orleans, which was pretty much 5 years after Hurricane Katrina. So I had an opportunity to see what happens when a young kid is carrying their dead sibling through floodwaters and they're being told they're a refugee. How does that look when they're a teenager? How does it look when they're a young adult? And so saw a lot of just long-term trauma, really great training, saw a lot of complications related to not having mental health resources available to someone. And so that led into going into forensic psychiatry, did the year training into that. And that was a very pivotal year for me because I started to realize that I was sensitive to a lot of things going on around other people other than just the knowledge base of their emotions. Like I realized there was something more subtle to it. So I noticed that I was having differences of how I responded to things compared to my peers at the time, where I'm going into a prison, I'm feeling the despair going on in the prison. I'm going to the courthouse where people are chained up and I can tell, okay, this is affecting me in certain ways and I need to understand that. And so that led to kind of really working with different people, non-traditional healers, understanding energy more and the subtleness of that and how we're all connected, and kind of led to a journey in that capacity where I started learning Reiki, which is a Japanese healing technique developed in the 1920s of sending energy and perceiving that and pretty much understanding being an empath. Before all the memes were talking about it, I was kind of navigating that by myself while also having medical knowledge and psychiatry knowledge to not have as an anchor to understand those things. And so eventually that just led to starting a private practice, getting interested in integrative health in Atlanta. Started my practice 6 months before the pandemic. So that was a pretty interesting process too. Yeah. A lot to learn.
So it's a lot to unpack there. I think the first thing I want to do is just hone in briefly on what impact culturally did your experiences in New Orleans and Atlanta and playing jazz even have on your worldview and the way that you see your patients and the work that you do today? Because it seems like I would presume that every, and this may be a false presumption, although I would stand on it, every psychiatrist or many or the overwhelming majority do not have that worldview or that cultural competency that you have. And so what impact does that have in your profession?
Right. And New Orleans is a small city, but it has a lot of history to it, a lot of culture to it. I think growing up there, when you are into jazz, you're understanding that based on how you play, you have to match other people near you as well. So it's like, it was my first time having this concept of emotional resonance amongst other people, because you have to go up with the music, you have to kind of decrease the volume, there's different styles of the music. And so I felt like that was such a big part of the culture growing up there, and having that as an anchor, I felt like it helped me relate to people without talking, you know, because you have to, you see the crowd, you're resonating with what they're doing, you're playing amongst your peers, and you have to kind of really be in sync with each other. And so I think it really helped with the nonverbal communication and empathic resonance from growing up playing jazz in such a city where you're around, you got a lot of competition too. So you kind of have to be good at what you're doing.
So one of the things that you talked about in your opening is the impact that all of this had on you. And so that's a unique experience, because when you go to your doctor or you go to your psychiatrist or your therapist or whomever it may be, shout out to Dr. Garcia, who's my therapist, whatever it may be, you kind of expect them to have all the answers, and it's unfair because you expect them not to go through these things. So how yourself do you prepare? And maybe you could talk about some of those traditions that you've learned or some of those alternative medicines that you've learned. How have you begun to take care of yourself? And then on a more basic level, when should someone, in your view, start to seek out a psychiatrist, and how should they go about finding one that's the best fit for them?
Right. So it's definitely important if you're in a healing arts to know how to take care of yourself, because you're going to be working with a lot of people throughout your career and it can sneak up on you like anyone else. And so I began to notice towards the end of my psychiatry training that, okay, there's some gaps here and knowledge that I need to better take care of myself that some of the traditional practices weren't fully covering. Like I had a therapist at that time and I found that very useful because I'm learning things while working with a therapist at the same time. And so it allowed for a really concrete integration of information. But I think that I saw that there were some gaps. I saw that burnout's pretty high in the medical profession. You know, we don't have the best mental health statistically, actually, and our suicide rates are pretty high compared to the average population. So knowing that, I knew that, okay, I can't really lean on my supervisors to really tell me how to take care of myself. And I'm noticing that as a Black man, I am more sensitive to what's happening. I'm more sensitive to going in these prisons and going into the courtroom. And so I need more of a support than maybe what's being allotted. So I found my way into the non-traditional healing path just from understanding that. I felt like it was a missing piece of information that was going to allow me to take care of myself. That's how I got into meditation. Outside of just like exercising, meditation became a very good anchor of stability, understanding, working with different healers and how they perceive consciousness and our connectedness amongst others. I found that very useful as well. And so, you know, I think just when you continue in the path of healing, you see your own wounds, because you see how we're all connected, because someone's coming in and they look like someone you're related to. Sometimes they're having the same issues that you're working on, you know? And so you're always reminded that, okay, we're connected. We're all working on different levels of that. But, you know, that was just something that I realized was going to be very important. And I've benefited so much by just being open to see every patient as a reflection of myself, and I'm a reflection of them. And the more I can hone in on that, the more I can actually be of service and also work on my own stuff at the same time. So it's a good bonus for the type of work that I do. And I forgot your second question was related.
No, I mean, when should someone, in your view, start to seek out a psychiatrist, and how should they go about one that best fits them?
Right. So usually by the time someone comes to see me, they probably should have came months ago, even years before they come to see me, because it can sneak up on folks, you know. And oftentimes if you go talk to a therapist, they'll let you know if you need a higher level of care to see a psychiatrist, because our focus is definitely on symptoms and what symptoms are colliding together to cause a mental health diagnosis. And so if you're not sleeping well, you have insomnia because your mind's racing at night and you're only getting 3-4 hours, yeah, that's a good time to come see us. If you're having panic attacks where you have a chest tightness, shortness of breath, you're finding yourself isolating from friends or from driving because of the anxiety, that's a good time to see us. If your depression is really affecting your concentration level, you can't focus on things the way you want to, you're not finding enjoyment out of life, your energy level is really low, you know, that's a good time to come talk to us. And so there are just some symptoms that the brain is very much impacted. You know, if you have certain chronic medical problems, that's impacting your brain as well. And so oftentimes we do focus on symptoms, working with a therapist, you know, in case you didn't want to go the medication route, that's great too. They'll let you know if you need to see a psychiatrist, but really entering the mental health space is just the first step. And we're pretty good at directing someone with subsequent quick care if you meet criteria for a high level that we're not providing. You just got to take that first step though.
I mean, that's interesting. Let me ask you like a personal question, not of you, but like for me, does weed help with any of this, or does it exacerbate it? Or what role does marijuana play and CBD play? When those are two different substances, but what role do they each play in this, in what you've learned about the healing process?
Right. I think as a psychiatrist, I mean, I've worked in California. People had marijuana cards before it was legal. So if you have all drugs are bad approach, you're going to miss a lot of patients and you're just going to shut the door to really understand why someone's using something. Nowadays, there's such the quality is enhanced, right? The THC percentage has gotten so high where, you know, after a while, I'm seeing people who initially used it for, they helped calm them down, they helped them to sleep. But then 2 years later, with the competitiveness of the market and the high THC content, they're noticing that they're getting more anxiety than benefits. And so every person's different. And usually when I have a patient who's like, well, I'm finding usefulness of CBD, which is like more than, you know, they're not the psychoactive components of the THC, right? Separated out. I'm noticing that I just pretty much ask them, okay, how are you using this? You know, what benefit is it bringing you? And some people have found a lot of success with CBD. Some people find success with using marijuana at certain doses. But if you're not, if you're still kind of seeing me, that means that it's probably not covering everything. So, you know, we need to revamp things. And is this out of habit? Are you actually benefiting from it? Is this spiking up your anxiety in certain ways? But if used correctly, if used with some medical supervision as well, because I mean, medical marijuana is definitely a field that's growing. They're finding more formulations. That's clearly something that's filling a gap because we're having many people with chronic pain. Some people don't respond well to prescription medications. So we're seeing it fill a gap. At the same time, it's a trial and error process of different products. You have to be open to trying to see which formulation works best for you. Be open to working with a mental health provider that's understanding of whatever your lifestyle may be. And so it's different. It doesn't always fit into like one broad stroke. Not everyone's going to benefit from it, but a lot of people do.
So just a random question that I forget to ask sometimes, but in your, the services you provide, do most employer provided insurance, does that cover what you provide?
So a lot of jobs will have their mental health, part of the health insurance, no cover. Many of us, including myself, don't take insurance for a number of different reasons. Usually when you're doing integrative health, you're introducing methodologies that aren't necessarily reimbursed by insurance companies. And so if I'm doing a Reiki with someone for an hour, insurance companies aren't reimbursing for that. If I'm like working on an individualized treatment plan that's involving, okay, you should talk to this person for yoga, you should try these herbal supplements, you know, they really reimburse certain services. But if you have a health savings account, they'll reimburse it. But, you know, there's different levels of psychiatric care, right? You can go to a community clinic, you can work with someone through a hospital, which takes your insurance. But the more you start to refine your approach and you get more into specialty, you will find more mental health providers that aren't taking insurance just because the type of services they're providing, it's just not, insurance companies don't pay for that, unfortunately.
You mentioned what you specialize in somewhat, but you specialize in forensics, integrative health, and psychotherapy. What does that mean? Let's break that down.
Yeah. So when you think of integrative health, we're just talking about the whole person, right?
What is Reiki? You said it a number of times, but like, what is it?
Yeah. So Reiki was developed in the 1920s in Japan. It's literally a practice in which someone's lying on a massage table and you're sending them energy through your hands, which sounds very hocus pocus, right? That's not something we're familiarized with at all. But when you start to think about fields such as like Tai Chi and Qigong, the subtle energy of movement within your body, these channels of energy flowing called Qi, is within that same framework. And so Reiki is just designed to help relax someone. It can help aid the body's ability to heal itself. So it's not a massage. It's only gentle touching at certain parts of the body. Sessions last between 30 minutes to an hour. Most people feel very relaxed afterwards. There's still a lot of like science research needed to understand what's taking place during the sessions. More hospitals are adding and involved in their cancer clinics because they're noticing that patients are noticing less pain and less anxiety, less trouble sleeping with these types of treatments. You know, Harvard's done a study recently showing that it was beneficial. So it is slowly taking more room in the medical space and the healing space, but there's still a lot to be understood about how it works. But integrative health is ultimately understanding not only someone's like disease process, but how they perceive it themselves and the different aspects that led to it. Because not anyone just comes with depression from out of nowhere, right? There might be certain things that they're eating or drinking or smoking. There may be certain thought patterns and behaviors that are also leading to the depression. There's genetic preloading, family history related things. You know, what's your diet? You know, how are you exercising? You know, so you're looking at all aspects of disease, basically, and not just the symptoms and some of the pathology, but the sources.
Well, let's change gears just slightly, but along the same line, and talk about COVID. How has the pandemic affected you personally and your practice? And what have you seen from your patients as a result of the pandemic in terms of the types of issues that they've raised with you?
Right. So before the pandemic, I was mostly seeing patients in person. I was doing some virtual care. I kind of saw the wave where it was like, okay, this is going to become a thing. I mean, it's just more convenient for people. I'm living in Atlanta. Traffic's horrible. So I saw patients. I gave them the option to go and after the in-person visit the first time, we can do virtual. And then they wanted to come back in the office again. So I was like, okay, I think this is probably going to be a trend. And then the pandemic happened and everything just turned right into virtual care, which was actually pretty awesome. I already had the infrastructure set up for that. And I saw a lot of people dealing with the same type of stress at the same time. So my practice shifted from this integrative approach to more just crisis management. Okay, people aren't sleeping, they have anxiety, everyone's worried about leaving their home and getting some deadly virus, right? So people are taking on more caretaking roles because schools are closed. And so now they're doing their job at home. Now they're taking care of the kids at the same time. And there's just a lot of friction happening at the home as a result. So I found myself really changing my business model overall to reflect virtual care, changing the integrative health more into, okay, this is just bread and butter psychiatry crisis management here. You know, what symptoms are taking place? Let me coordinate care with therapists. So virtual care became more of like the mainstay of my practice currently, which has allowed me to use like medical license. I'm licensed in multiple states, so it lets me use more of that. Also lets me work with a lot of patients that would have missed appointments because they would have missed, you know, when you're sick that day, you got to cancel. Now you can just be on the couch. Some people are more comfortable that way. Of course, it doesn't fit every type of mental health crisis taking place. There's still a need for in-person visits. There's still a need for ER. But that was a big, big shift there.
You know, one more question about COVID, and then I wanted to ask you more about your type of particular practice. Since we've been reemerging from quarantine and COVID, have you seen many of the issues that people were facing during COVID subside? Or have you seen the lingering effect and the trauma from this pandemic still lasting today?
Still lasting. Pandemics historically have always changed society. I think that we've become more heightened, you know. I mean, you're seeing, it's very complicated, right? There's so many different issues taking place at once. I mean, you have the mandates, right? That's caused a lot of people stress for justifiable reasons. You have the pandemic that's still going on, even though people want that to end. You have people who have long haul COVID symptoms, and now they have depression, anxiety problems because their brain was affected from getting COVID, or some people lost family members due to COVID. And, you know, due to just the stigma around COVID and how politicized it's been, they feel shame about that. They may have like accidentally got a family member killed as a result of like getting COVID and spreading it to the home. And so I'm seeing still, you know, a big gap in mental health resources, still heightened depression, anxiety. You know, we saw people were quitting jobs for a number of different reasons. And ultimately, yeah, I mean, the needs are definitely still up there. Even though people are returning back to work, and there's just not enough mental health professionals to really fill the gap right now, unfortunately.
When you talk about that scarcity or just, I don't know, you're not meant necessarily saying a scarcity, but simply not enough to meet the need of mental health professionals. You know, I do a lot of civil rights work, and I promise you, like three of the last four cases that I've been involved in, and one I just recently signed up, have been individuals going through a mental health crisis that were killed by law enforcement instead of being treated. One was actually killed in a mental health hospital, Jarvis Randall down at University Hospital in Miami, Florida. So talk to me about, and maybe this is something that it just kind of came to my head, but do you and your colleagues, or has there been some thought from psychiatrists or your national organizations about the role that you all play in a larger criminal justice reform, or a role that you all would play, although there is a scarcity, as you said, or not enough to fill the need, in a role that's not simply clinical, but also being helping with first responders, et cetera?
Overall, no. I tend to see it's one organization, right? But we have different specialties within that, and usually forensic psychiatry, psychiatry and the law. And so I think the field of psychiatry very heavily leans on us to have those types of conversation, but I still feel like there's a big gap there. I don't think it's really being approached enough. I want to take hostage negotiation training.
I want you to, trust me. I think if they could call you instead of the person who you know, shoots the beanbags, and that's supposed to be the hostage negotiator, we probably could save lives.
Yeah. And I never thought I wanted to do it. It's just, I see those, exactly what you're saying. I'm seeing those missing pieces, right? Like what would have happened if someone came in with a little bit more compassion and not so trigger happy, how that would have turned out in different cases that are really turning out unfortunate, right? And just seeing that representation matters, and, you know, you need different people having their own unique style into the mix when you're having a heightened sense of things, right? Because I mean, these issues aren't going away. We're seeing more violence. We're seeing more mental health issues. And when you combine mental health issues with substance abuse issues, the violence risk is pretty high with that. So those things aren't going away anytime soon.
You know, I particularly wanted to bring you on to hone in and talk about Black men and mental health.
Yeah.
As a Black man, you're a St. Aug grad from New Orleans, a Morehouse man, and Omega. So you know Black men. How much progress do you think we've made around stigmas and mental health with Black men, particularly as it relates to seeking help when mental health issues arise?
I've been actually, like, as much as so much going on right now, I've been feeling very optimistic. I'm seeing celebrities step up. I'm seeing athletes. I'm seeing musicians really showcase vulnerability, talking about their, you know, past suicide attempts, you know, talking about their issues with depression, anxiety. I'm seeing a level of vulnerability I haven't seen before, you know? And so I think we are making progress there. I'm seeing people use, you know, social media more productively in that capacity. We still have ways to go, right? Overall, we're catching up as a culture. You know, we weren't able to have these conversations. Our parents were really trying to keep their jobs. You know, they were trying to keep their jobs and they have time for sick leave or to showcase any vulnerability. But now we're starting to see that in order for you to actually ascend to your highest level, you know, you really have to keep your mental health together and you need to understand your mental health. That's a competitive advantage to really understand how you respond to stress, how stress affects you, how to work on coping skills, how to track your emotions over time, how to not let someone else pay for your emotions, you know, how to express yourself in productive ways, how to be in a space of just more compassion for yourself and others, you know, and if you do have those problems, how can you adequately seek out treatment for that. And so I am seeing progress. I think, you know, we got to be careful with social media, right? We don't want to tell all our business out there, but I am seeing if it's done a certain way, many people relate to that. So, you know, I definitely encourage anyone listening to this and anyone who's followed, you know, different celebrities and they're showcasing vulnerability, have those conversations with your friends. You know, we can use social media in very productive ways. It doesn't have to always be about, you know, the new things that we've done in our lives, but I think it just has to be used in the appropriate context though.
That makes perfect sense. You know, one of the, and I probably need to have our good friend Saida Grundy on here for this next question, but what role do you think the conceptions of masculinity play in keeping men from seeking the help they need?
Right. You know, emotional vulnerability as a man is something that, like, I've just had to evolve with myself. You know, we are chastised when we cry, right? Like when a boy cries, they're not consoled the same way when a girl cries, right? And that plays out into adulthood. You see this one kind of very straightforward view of masculinity, but we're very layered. We have a lot of complexities to masculinity, and pushing one agenda tends to, you know, make other aspects of us suffer. And so I think that, you know, the more that we show vulnerability, the more that we'll see the difference, the different resources that are available to us, the different support that can come in different ways. But yeah, we're going to have to shed that. You know, that's no longer viable. Yes. You know, it's not useful. We got to evolve to the times. I mean, we see that, you know, expressing yourself in a healthy way helps you get what you want, you know? So if you just want to actually make sure you're not getting in your own way, having a very, I'm a man, I have to express myself this way because that's what alpha men mean, you know, be the alpha man, that's what it means. But that's not actually true. You know, being alpha means that you are able to get people behind you and rally people behind you and get things done. And you have to be able to connect with other people and connect with yourself appropriately. And so, you know, we have to just kind of really just destigmatize masculinity, showcase that vulnerability, understand that that is actually strength. There's strength in the vulnerability. There's strength in understanding your emotions and accessing them when you need to. Because if you're suppressing stuff, it's going to play out in all types of different ways. It's going to work against you.
No question. One of the topics that's intrigued me lately, and my executive producer, Jared, and I talk about this all the time, particularly during COVID because of isolation, is the concern that I have about the strength and depth of friendships. And we always see, like, my wife and her friends, they're always there. It seems as if women actually get that right, whereas some men don't always have the kind of depth or intimacy in their friendships. Do you see this manifest itself with the men you see? And what homework would you give men about how to invest in their friendships such that those friendships are there to sustain them when their emotional difficulties arise?
Right. So I don't watch a lot of sports, but since most of my friends do, I'm always going to, like, watching games with them, and we're not talking with each other. We're, like, watching the game, talking about the stats, you know, having, like, beers, but, like, no one's really asking, how are you doing?
Yeah.
How are you holding up? You know, anything that we can do to help, like what's holding, you know, what's weighing you down these days. And so I think that we're good at collecting with each other, but I don't think we really have in-depth conversations where we're really assessing how someone's doing or feeling comfortable. We don't want to mess up the vibe, right? We're here to talk about, invent about things going on in our lives. And so I think that we have to start really just having, how are you doing? And actually mean the question, want someone to respond to it and give us a view of what's going on with them. And so I recently this weekend, I sent one of my friends a voice memo because I was like, we haven't talked in a while. I feel like, you know, another Morehouse grad. And I'm like, man, I feel like Morehouse kind of teaches us that, oh, don't talk to your friend unless you have some breaking news. You have some new dope job going on or something. Yeah, I'm just reaching out, man, to say hi. Like, I feel like we haven't talked in a while, man. I know Morehouse has us on that. We need some great updates in our life. But, you know, reach out if you ever need anything, man. And I hope you're well, you know. And I think we need to just kind of start connecting back to the how are you and really mean it and want someone to give us more input.
And mean it. You got to mean it. You know, people ask me that all the time. And so, most times I don't even respond because I know they don't mean it. It's just perfunctory. Look, my last question for you is a relatively selfish question because I'm also a father to a son. And I imagine that a lot of my listeners are as well. And I imagine in your work, you see a lot of childhood trauma manifest itself into adult mental health issues. So what's your advice to me or parents of boys who want to raise their children to be well-adjusted, well-rounded, and emotionally aware men?
Yeah, I think that it's important to, you know, if you want to like surefire way, mood tracking apps are really great, right? Depends on how old they are and their access to phones, of course, but if you have it on their minds that, you know, how are you doing? How are you feeling? How was your week? You know, trying to get them to reflect back on the past couple of days, you know, I think that's a really good way to start because you're training your child to reflect and look back and actually just be part of that process, communicating how they're feeling. And of course, different age ranges, you're going to get some, you know, resistance there, particularly when they're like teenagers, right? Like teenagers don't really like to talk about things. But I think that if you set a structure in which you're just asking, how was your week? You know, what did you like? What didn't you like? That's one way to go about things. When things unfortunate happen, to have a dialogue about that. And obviously they're children, so it's not going to be a very in-depth conversation. But as long as you're the safe space, you know, you're the safe space where they can go and talk to you about things that they may not feel comfortable talking to many people about. They're talking to friends about all types of stuff, right? So correct. You want to be that person where, okay, if something's going on, you talk to me first so we can do something about it. And I think if you just, you know, trust that even if they say they're doing something that makes you mad, I think just leaving space to allow them that safety so that you're the go-to person when things go awry, you're just going to catch things much faster and you'll be able to intervene much faster as well. But never discount really, you know, just challenging your child to express how they feel, you know, and actually just help them practice that because they're going to feel all the feelings of this life, right? And it's going to get expressed in different ways. And so find a way to really hone it in to be very useful.
Yeah. I talk to Stokely all the time. I always let him, you know, I'm not the father that says stop crying, right? I'm always like, why are you crying? Are you sad? Does something hurt? Like, tell me about it. Right. I don't know if it's going to work, but hopefully, you know, he grows up decently adjusted and not on America's Most Wanted. I mean, that's kind of the goal.
Right. So,
my brother, doctor, you deserve that. You just can't call you Thomas. It's Dr. Thomas Oden. You work too hard for that, my brother. Thank you for joining. Tell everybody how they can find you, where they can find you, if they need your services, even virtually, where they can get you.
Sure. So my website, my clinic is odenpsychiatry.com. I'm on Instagram, always just putting out just different content. So that's dr.thomasoden. Those are the main ones I use these days. And yeah, feel free to reach out. If you have any mental health questions, more than happy to assist.
It's my brother. Thank you so much. Hope to see you guys. I mean, I guess it's going to be either Candle in the Dark or the next homecoming when we bump into each other. But I hope I do see you soon, man.
Yeah, likewise, man. You take care. Good to see you.
Thank you, man. Be easy. All right, guys, we're going to play Sandstorm. Yes, Sandstorm. at the beginning of this outro, because before I let you go, I have to shout out my Gamecocks for a signature win over the Florida Gators this past Saturday, beating them 40-17. Beat them down. This is big because the Gamecocks found some offense and a quarterback in Jason Brown, and we're one game away from bowl eligibility, facing three very winnable games the rest of the schedule in Missouri, Auburn, and Clemson. I wasn't a fan of the Bama hire, but if we can keep this team playing like we did on Saturday, I'll be happy to say I was wrong about Bama. So let's beat Missouri and show them what the real Columbia is. And that's that on that. We'll see you on Thursday.